thank you all for coming to the Green Arcade. I want to thank our panelists tonight, or our speakers, our contributors. This is an evening of readings, discussion, and solidarity with activists in women's prisons. Tonight we're going to have Vanessa Wong, who is a poet, a writer, a community activist, and she is a contributor to this new book called The Revolution Starts at Home, Confronting Intimate Violence with Activists Within Activist Communities, which is hot off the press, from the South End Press. Also, Sin Sirocco, who wrote a fabulous book called Lobite, which was published by PM Press and takes place in a California women's correctional institution. And it's about the joys of insurrection and surviving. And Victoria Law, who's an activist from Manhattan, all the way, and wrote Resistance Behind Bars, which struggle of incarcerated women. And also Karen Shane, thank you for coming tonight, and she's the policy director of legal services for Prisoners with Children, which is has their offices right here on Market Street, just about two blocks from here. So without further ado, I don't know who wants to talk first, but...
Mm-hmm.
Vanessa?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, Vanessa's going to open the evening.
You're
thank
open.
You. Thank you for having us.
Let's see, I'm going to adjust this down a little bit.
Okay, here. I actually have to do this.
Oh.
Tell me what...
Oh, that's perfect.
Is that good? Yeah?
I can see everybody. Just leave this right here?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for coming out. Okay, so Vicki invited me to share some poetry as part of tonight's gathering. So that's what I'm going to do. Yeah, I'm excited. It's probably the last time that I saw you more regularly, I wouldn't be reading poetry. I would be doing something else. So I wanted to open tonight with an activist that some of you have been able to know, and I thought that I would get to meet one day, and I didn't in body, but in spirit. Her work has definitely touched my practice and the practice of so many people in this room and beyond this room. So this is a poem for Marilyn Buck. Dear Marilyn, I heard the storming ululation in this photograph we reach for to remember your life by. Soft-hearted, still seething, unprunable in today's cypress flame. That still fencing shutter turned from Lebanon's skyward village streets, another farewell dance of rice and roses. I've never seen a photograph like this, snapped by a friend walking the prison flower line, your courage heart so bare, so mum, so bare, so generous, even mum's burst from masqueraded feeling. Each glance a reminder to resist relegation as object for tomorrow's campaign. No, we do not mourn you of loss, but in prayer that we may carry on your steel spirit, uncaptured even by the mum-stealing corrosion of your jailer's sarcoma.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. Okay, so I'm going to do one more poem before we go to Sin, and then I'll do another one later on for our Q&A. Okay, this poem I wrote at the turn of the 2009-2010 New Year. after seeing some friends who are at the Central California Women's Facility during Christmas time. Dear executioners, this is the year angels unravel your promise. Enduring prayer, hearts fly home for the holidays. Stay for each and all the days. Wear bread for all, reign free. This is the year no angel sacrifice your pain. No plea for life, need breath. Your swollen feet return to visit each one you've put away. This is the year you resolve to face each sin, confess humanity with the rest of us, pilgrims each and all. This is the year angels lynched by your pen and coffee, angels still keeping watch inside, return and bless each memory. This is the year all Earth's children witness your prison. Secrets broken so no child, no shiver of hunger, shame, mum stealing. The year each child remember what it is to be curious, free from judgment gaze, relearn home in body. This is the year we uproot toxic spread, barbed wire, watchtower, pray for each serving lie of lock and key. This is the year each immigrant shriveled under gavels learned, command, lay to rest, medicine, earth's palm, massaging temple of our sky. The year new days reign your wildfire. This is the year strip searches and forced sterilization become sorrows of our past. Doctors and wardens find their own forgiveness enough to imagine reparation for war on baby's breath. The year we each find breath enough to imagine new practice, collect bouquet for each fallen soldier who braved this trespass. If we have learned to hear prayer of ghosts on Angel Island, then this is the year. If we felt pollution from Alcatraz enough to shut a prison down and dandelions still root, then this is the year. If Attica reminds us that patience shake foundation enough to threaten your hold, wake sun gods, no freedom for a moment, then this is the year. So may each finger sorrow find joy enough to loosen your mallet grip and rest in prayer with the angels. So, Sin.
Is your poem in a book?
Not yet. I'm working on it. Mm-hmm.
I was actually going to read the riot scene. Now, some of you have heard it so many times. Do you actually want me to? Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Let's see, where shall I begin? Birdeye had reached some kind of critical mass. Fucking prison. Fucking girlfriends, checks, Christmas. She'd been looking forward to fucking her way through Christmas up to her early January parole. Didn't look like it was going to happen. She grabbed the lopsided Christmas tree, dragged it out of the rec room, corny paper ornaments falling in its wake. The cold winter daylight made the scrubby little tree look forlorn as Birdeye walked around it intoning solemn ritual curses. We wandered over, filled with the general malaise. Isn't right, this. What'd you expect, this prison girl? For real. They're gonna kill her, they find her. Somebody had just escaped. I'm going to kill her, I find her. Fuck up my Christmas. They ain't gonna find her. Lily long gone from around here. Said on the news an old guy held up a liquor store in town. Was probably her. No way. She gone. The news. Geez, hey, did you hear the press release about it? She armed and dangerous. Armed and dangerous. Well, that's some consolation. Birdeye flicked her lighter once or twice, then leaned forward to watch the tree catch on fire. It burned with a satisfying snap. Thea, who'd never learned to fear fire or anything else, grabbed its stubby trunk, flipped it end over end in a great flaming arc towards the center of the circle. Perversely, it went out. Perverse, we trotted over, started it up again. The little burning tree gathered quite a crowd. Hasty loudspeaker voices. We murmured among ourselves, casual, discussing the bonfire. There wasn't any plan or purpose behind the thing. It was spontaneous. Spontaneous. There was something proud, heady, about everybody ignoring the voice of authority. It didn't happen often in prison. We watched women spinning in circles with their arms wrapped around each other, tossing Christmas ornaments like colored footballs, hoping simply to prolong the rush.
Ladies, ladies, return to your cottages.
We stood our ground, grinning. More trees were dragged over, surprise guards chasing along behind, raving about the Christmas spirit, about tradition. A few garbage cans made a noisy rolling ambush as the guards turned the corner. More got thrown at the windows. Fires leaped up, expanded like Chinese fireworks.
Anyone not in their cells in 5 minutes will be in deep trouble.
It was all very satisfactory. Thea and Quinny had jimmied a side window into the clinic. They were methodically stowing anything that even looked like it might fly when, much to their dismay, ravening banshee women crashed in the front door. Birdeye went through the main guard's desk looking for the keys to the dispensary. Where the hell is Morgan? This be a piece of cake for her. Hey, somebody go find Morgan. I had business of my own elsewhere. No one was certain where the guards were. They seemed to have scattered like a flock of little birds when the mob came crashing in the door. Wise move. Convenient, anyway. China went down the hall to the lab. A supply of clean points would make life infinitely easier. All anything anyone else was coming up with were Band-Aids, aspirin. Someone suggested that's all they used, even for surgery. Thea slammed the door off another locked cabinet. Nothing. Never any medicine when you want it in here anyway. Might as well go back outside. Thea flashed a self-satisfied smile which belied her works. Her pockets were bulging with material for sales. Concoctions. Quinny came out of surgery looking righteously pissed. No painkillers anywhere except for Tylenol, fucking Vicodin. Grab the Vicodin. It's not bad by the handful, girl. Grab it yourself. This place is history. When Quinny looked questions at Thea, Thea nodded with the tiniest of smiles. Scored again, dearies. Scored again. Rubbish was piled up against the buildings, set on fire. Women stood around, hopping from one foot to the other, waiting for the walls to come tumbling down. The place was all bricks and concrete, so it didn't happen. Most of us thought about hitting the fence, then decided to party a while, go back to our cells, lock in, prepare for another day. The voice from the loudspeaker seemed to make every announcement over and over again in Swahili for all the attention it got. Hup, 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 the guards from the men's prison came in, lined up with their shiny white helmets, glowing by the light of the perimeter spots like hundreds of eggs. They trotted around in little circles of a dozen men apiece, looking grim. Tangent,
Face masks in place, batons at the ready, shotguns, tear gas canisters, ready, ready, ready. The men lumbered forward in step, batons horizontal, shields forming a solid reflecting wall. As the tax squad went through its proto-military rituals, the women closest to them took up positions in the shadows. No special plans. Simple curiosity, the men formed up again, trotting in place. The tactical squads were annoyed, nothing more, at the crazy women banshee hooting, tossing burned trees and garbage in the air. It seemed a messy but cheerful sort of riot. But these special squads were unfamiliar with the layout of the place, strangers to the terrain, the shortcuts. It seemed a simple matter, since the place was so flat, to go in, subdue us with masculinity and tear gas, accept the grateful thanks of the administration, and buzz off for beers. When their strategic maneuvers had little or no effect, they fired off their tear gas in every direction, swearing manfully when the wind shifted. They used their clubs with a rhythmic, whistling sound, smashed the little crowds of women. Get back, damn you! Get out of the way! The men realized there was no place to put us. All the cell blocks had filled with tear gas. They tried to bludgeon us into the ground. There was a pause while the men formed up again, adjusting their gas masks, breathing heavily. Brunei and China set up a wet towel brigade, an emergency medical station by the drinking fountain, witch hazel and Vaseline for tear gas burns, Tylenol and Band-Aids for bruises, the best the clinic had to offer. Most of us know enough to be able to do some fancy flying on adrenaline alone in situations like these. The advancing men broke, finally, with a gratifying stagger. They retreated to fall tangled in a clothesline web that Thea and Queenie had hooked up. Then Thea and Queenie turned the fire hose on them, main valve all the way open. The riot squad stopped tear-gassing themselves for the moment, began to regroup not 15 feet away from where Birdeye and China argued in the smoke. Birdeye pulled China into the dirt, leaving the argument for another day as rubber bullets sang just over their heads, thudding into the wall behind them. I think I'm going to throw up. Just stay low. They don't even know we're here. They slithered off on their bellies towards the school building where I was doing some serious work. I knew the procedure. If the convicts didn't trash the place, the police certainly would. I had to get the hooch out of the law library, or it could be the extinction of all sentient life on the planet. Birdeye and China were almost on top of me before they noticed me crouched low in front of the last lock into the law library. Holy Mother of God, we haven't got enough time. I was glad for their help. It was complicated to dismantle the still in the half-light. The hoses were tangling. Stinking liquid dribbled out on our clothes, on the floor, drooling on the books every time we looked away. We worried under our breath about where to hide the parts so it could be reassembled. Thea and Queenie drove up an electric golf cart the guards used to transport themselves from one end of the compound to the other. We piled the still in back, cradling the bottles of Finnish hooch in towels. I rushed back to do a cursory mop-up, pick up a couple files, relock the doors. Wet towels over our faces, we raced through the surging crowds back to our deserted unit, peeled the heating vent cover off the wall in the rec room, plopped the still inside. The heating system hadn't worked in years. We went back outside just to see Narcisse, who is a deaf woman, being snuck up behind by the police. Deuce screamed. Narcisse seemed to sense something. She began to turn. One of the men grabbed her. The other slammed his club, slicing against the back of her skull. They didn't give her a glance as they moved forward to secure the next 10 yards. Deuce heaved a brick at one of them. He fell to his knees. Narcisse didn't quite lose consciousness. She was unaware of her blood slopping with raindrop sands into the dirt. She tried to stand up, bringing her legs under her chest, bracing herself with her arms against the dizziness, the pain. Forcing herself upright, she held onto the building for support. Clouds of tear gas obscured the light. The eerie flickering of the little fires distorted people, elongated the shadows, the world askew, sloping at an unpleasant angle. She vomited. Deuce reached her arms out, crooning. Oblivious, Narcisse made small mewling sounds, touching her face and head with unbelieving hands. We carried her over to the water fountain. Deuce washed and wrapped her head, murmuring to her, forgetting perhaps that Narcisse couldn't hear, perhaps talking just to give herself the comfort of a voice. The frantic loudspeaker still blared orders in a steady, hysterical scream. Water hoses squirted the riot squad from all directions. There was the eerie hiss and pop of tear gas, the sporadic thudding of rubber bullets. It was late. Thea and Queenie hunkered at the base of a tree, swigging hooch, commenting on the show. A thin wire strung chin high across the path. They were looking for a decapitation.
Thank you, Sin. How many of you know about the riot that Sin based this on before you heard her read or you read about this?
Which riot was it?
Do you want to tell her a little bit about the riot before I start? The actual riot that you based this on?
This is in the late 70s, and there was a great deal of political activism within all of the Pelican prison. What I found being political, but also being a completely ordinary, smart-ass convict, was that rather than sitting around thinking about people that another people did, it was more effective to talk about the them and us and who actually was the us. The upshot of this particular riot was that while we were all on lockdown, I circulated a petition that had to do not merely with prison conditions, but with the sentencing. And because inside a prison, actually anything can get anywhere, whether you're locked down or not. And so it circled during lockup virtually the whole prison, and people who had no particular political foundation wrote their suggestions all over this, and it finally came back to me, and the California legislature sent a couple congresspeople to the prison, and we did a conference and explained our positions. One of the cute things that everybody pretty much agreed on was that no one should do longer than 5 years in prison. And the reasoning behind this is that much past 5 years, it is very difficult to re-acculturate in a healthy manner back into the populace on the grips. We carry so many things that have been ingrained in terms of reaction, which are lovely for survival and lovely for pride and general assholery, but they will make people's lives on their grips a lot more difficult. After the legislature came in, they asked for two convicts to come to speak to the full California legislature. And the warden chose one of their secretaries, who was a lovely black Hawaiian lady who was just, she was a professional, and she was the warden's secretary, and she was dainty and well-spoken and lovely, and what they didn't realize was that she was a very good friend of mine. And so the convicts chose me to appear, and on the way there, being driven with all the police and everything else to the well, legislature, I'm there with my ratty jeans and my t-shirt and my bandana on my head, and she is there with a little handmade Chanel, pink Chanel suit, and she turned to me and she said, "What should I say?" And I said, "Here's the 10 points. So the legislature got our basic prison positioning from all the women in CIW at that time about what conditions should be, about how long a sentence should be, about the treatment of people as human beings. And first they got it from this lovely, well-spoken woman, and then they got it from the radical loudmouth. Unfortunately, as we all know, outside of theater, this doesn't actually seem to have impressed anybody. But we did have the time of the guards checking out from the windows. I think the important thing about this is that it was a small step in ordinary criminals who had never felt a sense of self, a sense of worth, a sense of power, being able to do something, which was dramatic, it was a lot of fun, and it was in some cases slightly effective. I think the only real thing which came out of it was that for 6 months, there were vegetarian choices in the mess hall. That didn't last very long, but small thing. And, you know, to support what the other women were here tonight talking about, women cannot be dismissed, period. Whether they're incarcerated, whether they're cooking, whether they're drug fiends or, you know, bank tellers, there is an incredible power in women.
Thank you, Sin. So, given that nobody knew about this riot that she just talked about, I'm going to do a little exercise which some of you who've seen me before have taken part of, and I expect you to take part in it again, unless you forgot about it. So, if we are not even remembering the riots and the uprisings and the rebellions in women's prisons, then we should be asking ourselves, you know, like, well, if we're not seeing those, then is it any surprise we're not seeing any of the less visible, less glamorous, less exciting, less, you know, less violent, clashing, organizing and resistance that's going on? So I'm going to take a couple of minutes to ask you, what do you think about when I say, what are the issues in women's prisons? What comes to mind? Just shout out
what
stuff. Sexual assault and rape by prison staff members. Other issues?
Healthcare.
Healthcare is atrocious in both men's and women's prisons. So I'm not going to say that in men's prisons they're living the high life, but if you think of men's prisons, you know, like there's like the substandard healthcare, but there's a baseline. And then when you think about women's prisons, there's often not the specific needs that women have for healthcare. Like there's no, there's nothing having to do with pregnancy or pap smears or breast cancer or cervical cancer or any of these other issues that are very gender specific. Yes. He said that the kids of women imprisoned getting taken away, and children of incarcerated mothers are 5 times more likely to end up in foster care than children of incarcerated fathers. And in 1997, Congress passed the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act that mandates that if a child is in foster care for 15 of the past 22 months, the social work staff in the state have to start terminating parental rights. And again, because of the way we gender parenting in the society generally, this then affects women who are in prison or mothers who are in prison more than it does men who are in prison. Other issues that come to mind when you think about women's prisons or women in prison?
Drug war.
The drug war, yes. That is like a huge, that has exploded the prison population, but it's particularly exploded like the women's prison population given the way that some of the legislation has been enacted. Like in 1986, Congress passed the Anti-Drug Abuse Act, which allows prosecutors to go after the spouses and lovers and partners of people with drug offenses, which means that they can charge him with conspiracy. And oftentimes, all that they were guilty of is doing anything that you do when you live with a person. You sign for a package, you take a phone message, and because they don't have anything more, to any more information than John called at 3 and this package arrived in the mail the next day, they don't have any information to trade for a lesser sentence. So oftentimes they'll be stuck with this conspiracy charge. Vanessa, you had?
Yeah, just to tease out women in prison or gender more,
violence, like physical, sexual, emotional violence against non-conforming
communities,
mm-hmm.
and women's prisons, and transgender communities.
Yes.
Okay. Other issues? Well, self-defense is a very common, recurring thing if the woman defends herself against somebody that's beating her up and perhaps even kills him, that she'll go to prison forever.
Mm-hmm. And tied into that is abuse and battering. So studies have shown, and these studies are people with like clipboards that go into women's prisons, so you have to assume that the number reported is much higher because most people don't want to divulge deeply personal and traumatic information to some stranger with a clipboard, that more than half of women in state prisons and jails report having experienced physical and or sexual abuse prior to their arrest and incarceration, and that women in prison are 3 times more likely than men in prison to have been physically or sexually abused, again, prior to their arrest and incarceration. So again, you can kind of see how gender and power dynamics play out and then are exacerbated, you know, in the prison setting. Other issues come to mind? Okay. So I'm going to read a counterpoint, I guess, to Sin's really exciting riot scene, you know, which is the organizing and resistance that battered women were doing in women's prisons that don't necessarily, you know, like attract media attention and doesn't have the same type of visibility and glamour that a riot does, but it's hugely important in any case. So, I'm going to start. In some cases in women's prisons, groups that were originally formed to support individual women on a path to recovery became more political as women realized that they had come to prison, not simply because of their individual choices, but because both society and the legal system were stacked against them. Such was the case with the LIFE, or Looking Inward for Excellence group, in Marysville, Ohio. The LIFE group was originally formed in the early 1980s as a support group for women serving life sentences. It was made up of all women that were doing life, and it was sort of like a big support system within itself, because when you're doing life, you had nothing there. All the programs are made up for people with short time. It's about getting you educated or whatever, because you're moving on to society. And we were not going back. And so we needed something to kind of get through. As time went on, members began discussing how the institution was run and actions they could take to improve their conditions. Recognizing that many members had been sentenced to life imprisonment for killing their abusers, the group began working around issues of domestic violence, particularly petitioning for clemency for survivors of domestic violence. In 1990, the group met with Linda Ammons, aide to then-Governor Richard Celeste, and Celeste's wife Dagmar. Their stories of abuse and imprisonment for self-defense moved both Ammons and Celeste, both of whom worked to organize a process in which women incarcerated for self-defense could request clemency. LIFE members spoke with other prisoners and encouraged survivors of domestic violence to apply for clemency. In some instances, LIFE members helped women overcome denial about their abuse, understand that they had been abused, remember incidents of battering, and recall where documentation of their experiences might be found. Their efforts led to 18 additional women to apply for clemency. So keep in mind that this is 18 women who might have stayed in prison and thought that they had somehow deserved this abuse and deserved to be in prison for killing their loved ones. Members also began monitoring parole board hearings, timing the amount of time that each woman spent before the parole board. One woman said, "We were sort of taking inventory about how many minutes did you stay in that hearing room when you went?" Some women said 3 minutes, 4 minutes. Well, how could you tell a life story in 3 or 4 minutes? They encouraged women to write follow-up letters to Governor Celeste about events they had forgotten in their applications or brief explanations to the parole board. These actions countered the usual way that prisons operated. According to one life member, whose application for clemency had been successful, she said, "We were sending out for articles, and we would share it. But when you're in the institution, you get to be kind of secret. But as we started to get information, we would put packets of stuff together, illegally Xerox stuff, and kind of under the cover of, read this, you know, this is good reading." And at the end, 25 women were granted clemency. This was the first successful mass clemency for women incarcerated for self-defense in the nation. The Actions of Life group inspired women at the California Institution for Women to organize their own clemency drive. Members of Convicted Women Against Abuse, the support group that Marsha Bunny had helped form, wrote a letter to then-Governor Pete Wilson, asking him to consider commuting their sentences and inviting him to one of their weekly meetings so that he could understand how they had ended up in prison. Although the governor declined the invitation, the letter drew the attention of lawyers and advocates who offered to help the women draft arguments and gather evidence for their own clemency petitions. In the end, Wilson granted clemency to 3, denied it to 7, and made no decision on 24 of the petitions. This did not dissuade women from continuing to use Convicted Women Against Abuse meetings to share current news regarding domestic violence, homicide cases, and court rulings, and their own experiences with the justice system. They also continued to discuss possible legal strategies, media stories about women who fight back, and journalists with a focus on domestic violence. The advocates and lawyers who originally helped Convicted Women Against Abuse with their petitions did not disappear either. They formed the California Coalition for Battered Women in Prison and continued organizing and raising public awareness around the issue. Over 15 years later, the group, now called Free Battered Women, which is now joined with California Coalition for Women Prisoners, which is right down the block there, continues to advocate for the release of women in prison for self-defense. Both Life Group and Convicted Women Against Abuse began as domestic violence support groups, operating with administrative approval. However, without the group's work around educating their peers about domestic violence and empowering them to speak out about their experiences, the Clemency Project would not have occurred on the same scale. In addition, women who had suffered domestic violence, whether they were ultimately released or not, would have continued to feel alone in their experiences and ashamed to talk about them. So keep that in mind when you think about what resistance and organizing looks like, is that sometimes it doesn't look like what we typically think of. Thanks.
I feel like this is kind of like old home week. I have so many thoughts from each of you, and I think I want to start with Vanessa and then just sort of go down the line, because Marilyn Buck was a very dear friend of mine, and I visited her for many years at the Dublin prison, the prison that's right out here, outside of Oakland. And when I've read your poem, I've actually never heard it, you know, and it did bring that all back. And one of the things that Marilyn really taught so many of us, let me just back up and say Marilyn Buck was a political prisoner. She was incarcerated twice, but essentially she was incarcerated because of her support for the Black Liberation Army and for eventually for helping in the escape of Assata Shakur, who was a leader of the Black Liberation Army and who's now living in Cuba. And Marilyn did essentially a great deal of time. I'm trying to remember exactly what it was, something like 28 years in prison. And in the last couple of years made a decision that she would try to go for parole. She did get parole. And then just before she was released, well, within the last 6 months before her release, she was diagnosed with sarcoma and died 17 days after she was released. And it was an enormous loss, but I think that as time goes on and we're all sort of settling down from the loss aspect, what the memory is of Marilyn is this, starting with a very young woman who was very feisty and really learned a lot through her life and taught a lot about being strategic and trying to figure out what you can do in one situation and what you can't do in that situation. And so it's just, it was interesting. I'm very glad you started with her, because it's sort of, she, her spirit is so much about resistance and about sisterhood and about, like, really trying to work with other women in the prison. And it wasn't always easy, as you well know, having been there, is that people can really get on your last nerve. And that was also part of who Marilyn was and who she really tried to express to people. Marilyn was also a poet, an extraordinary poet, and I don't know if you have any books of hers here. She has a book out, but Through City Lights, and maybe we should get some. I'm not even sure whether they still have any copies of it. So moving from there to CIW, which is so interesting, because when I suspect we're approximately the same age, I don't know, but I used to visit at CIW in the 70s. It was the first women's prison that I spent any amount of time not as a prisoner. I never did long periods of time, but I did a lot of little bits of time for political activities in the 60s and 70s. But CIW changed my life, because I realized that, that people in prison, it wasn't only women, but the women was who I was most interested in, were in many ways just like me, with some major, major differences, and of course the main difference being about race and privilege. But I decided at that point in my life that this is something I want to dedicate my life to, is working with people in prison. And I've been lucky enough, in one form or another, and it's been in many different forms, to continue to work with women in prison. And I started working at Legal Services for Prisoners with Children in 1995, during a lull in the battle to free these battered women who were incarcerated at that time, no longer only at CIW. Their second large prison for women had opened in Chowchilla, the Central California Women's Facility. Soon, very soon after I started working, the third large prison in California, Valley State Prison for Women, was open. And suddenly California had the largest number of women incarcerated in the country and the largest compound of women incarcerated in the world, in the two Chowchilla prisons. And so it sort of brought it all back in one form or another. And the interesting thing is that during that period with convicted women against abuse, as you were saying, 34 women applied for clemency. 3 women got it, one of whom died about 2 weeks after she was released. And another woman, it took another 10 years to get her out. What Wilson, the governor at that time, did was he gave clemency in terms of giving her an end term to her sentence, but it was 10 years out. And so really he released one woman who was able to get out pretty quickly. But just within the last month, the 30th woman has been released through this second wave of the attempt by women, really led by women at CIW still, although now it's a statewide movement, to really develop a network with free battered women, with my office, I'm happy to say, the Habeas Project, where we've managed to pair up attorneys and advocates with each individual woman. After we had to change the law, it's all complicated, but it's all happening finally, and we believe we could get another 20 out this year because of just with the change in the governorship. Where's some wood to knock on? Jerry Brown is not my favorite person, but he does seem to understand the law about letting the parole board do its job. And the parole board seems to understand the law about if you're, well, they've been forced to understand the law because there have been huge lawsuits and constant lawsuits, and the judges are getting very tired of the California Parole Board and have essentially said, you have to start letting people out. So it's an exciting time for lifers. It's a very exciting time for battered women. It's also an exciting time for men who are doing life terms because finally they are also beginning to get out. So I could just blather on. I just want to say two more things, and then we should open it up for discussion. One is there are three women who have been approved for parole who are waiting to get the way California law works, it's sort of confusing. The parole, you're a lifer, you're supposed to get out 7 years to life, 30 years, it doesn't matter. You have to go to the parole board. The parole board makes a decision to let you out, and then that decision is reviewed by the governor. So it's been a very difficult process. Approximately, of all the people that go to the parole board, something like 3% of them get approved for parole. And until this year, which seems to be doing a little better, but under Gray Davis, he let 4 people out during his entire 6-year term or however of those people. So he was less than 1% of the people who were approved. Schwarzenegger was the best in the last several years, and he let out something like 3% of the people who were approved. So Jerry Brown, I have to give him credit, he's letting people out at a rate of about 85% of the people approved. Why it's not 100, I can't tell you. But anyway, so we think that there will be many more, hopefully, in the next year or so getting out. So I do have, though, where there's a petition, every time somebody gets to the point of getting approved by the board, there's a petition campaign that goes along with the legal activities that happen to go to the governor. So I have 3 petitions, so I want to make sure that I get them to you. The other thing that's happening is, as policy director, we've been doing more work in Sacramento, which has it has its pluses and negatives, but it's good side and it's bad side. It's something, you know, that frankly it's the only game in town right now, so it's been kind of interesting. But there is a bill that has been happening now. It's the second try. This year it's going to pass, which is it's a bill to end the shackling of women during their pregnancy. That in California, 6 years ago now, we managed to pass a law to ban shackling of pregnant women during labor, delivery, and recovery. But for anyone who's ever given birth, you might remember that labor, delivery, and recovery was about maybe at most 24 hours in a 9-month process. So we're going back and trying to fix that other 9 months, essentially, of women going in and out of county jail, girls in juvenile hall going in and out of juvie, pregnant, going to the doctor, going to court, all of it belly shackled, ankle shackled, attached to other people. And so we're trying to fix that this year. And last year, the bill was passed unanimously. There was never a single vote against it in the Assembly or in the Senate, and it was vetoed by Governor Schwarzenegger. So we're back this year, and we're sort of following the same path. So far, it's gone through the Assembly Public Safety Committee and the Appropriations, and still nobody has voted against it. But we, you know, as I was saying, Jerry Brown is a hell of a lot better than Schwarzenegger in some ways. We don't totally trust that he's going to do the right thing either. So we are doing again another signature campaign, to support that bill. So I also have petitions for that. So there's really, actually, in many ways, a lot going on in the prisons now. There's a pretty active mothers group happening at Valley State Prison for Women where they're really working together to learn what the law is, representing each other, trying to get visitation with their kids. Just a lot going on there. The long-timers organizations in all 3 prisons, women's prisons, are very active. So it's kind of a good time to, it's not a good time to be in prison, but it's a more hopeful time to be in prison than it has been in many other times. So that's what I have to say.
I'm going to just put these.
And before we get to the Q&A, Vanessa's going to close us out with a poem, and then we can do any Q&A or discussion or if people have other comments or questions. Okay.
I wrote this poem, I'll just share, I don't know why, when I was on I was staffing the TGI Justice Project, the Transgender, Gender, Variant, Intersex Justice Project, which offices are not too far from here either. But we were visiting some of our comrades in New York City to learn from their organizing, the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, Queers for Economic Justice, and Audre Lorde Project, Trans Justice. And so this poem came out of, you know, not just that trip and that journey, but the broader journey. But it was most immediately sort of inspired by some of that direct organizing that our comrades in New York City were doing against transphobic violence in the city's welfare and shelter systems, and also connected to all of these struggles here in California prisons. It's called Manifesto, and it's in the Revolution Starts at Home, which Vicky talked a little bit about. We believe in home, all home, all beautiful. Home enough bellies breathe and sigh, enough skin rest dance free, enough courage carry all life. This a home no landlord, tenant, bank imagine, no passport, jail, shelter claim, no developer gift, no reparation furnish. This home free a body crossing and shame, free a memory break, no shame, all beautiful. This home pray for lost and stolen, home now free, a traveling fence, finger and sky breaking open, free enough many home, many body, home and whole together. Home safe and full spirit prayer, body prayer full desire, home wider song and cooking, wider shape of wood, brick and stone, home wider shapes weave together. Full and wide enough spirit return to body, enough whole body, each body, heart body, holy, beautiful. Holy, so holy, body homeless turn home again. We want home, all beautiful. Home alive, so alive, heart brave thunder shake out a hiding. So holy beautiful, and so holy brave. Every body home, and every body free. Open it up to Q&A.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Questions, anyone? Comments? Really? Truly? Okay.
I'm just wondering where the guards and prison system gets off on watching women being shackled up right now. That's got to be a sexual hit of some kind.
Wait, why they are allowed to? Or
no, no,
how
yeah,
they...
why they're doing it. It makes absolutely no sense, right?
Interestingly...
So, are they jerking off to it, or what's the trick?
Who knows? I can't possibly answer that question.
People weren't in there. What's the take, right?
But interestingly enough, the Prisons Guards Union this year have written, actually testified in support of this bill this year.
Uh-huh.
There's been an interesting shift with the prison guards, which is that I think one thing is they realize that it's a hell of a lot harder to guard people if they're miserable and all of that than if they're actually able to give them a little. And, I think it's a sort of a buy-off thing. I think they're also looking for support because they're not getting it from the Department of Corrections anymore, which is trying to figure out how they can lay them off. Who knows? But, I agree with you. There's something totally strange and off about shackling pregnant women. But I have to tell you, it's not, they're told to do it. They're not doing it out of just their every, the policies in these prisons and jails. This covers juvenile facilities, county jails and the state prisons. And, you know, the basic rule of the land is to, anytime you move somebody out of a prison, shackle them up. If you're putting them on a bus, make sure they're tied down to the bus. And, you know, and it doesn't make sense. And there's no comprehensible reason why they do it. But it's not, they're not doing it just because they want to get off on it. They're told to do it.
Probably because they're following orders, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think on a systemic level, it's like the use of prisons as a tool, right, is used to control whole populations of people, and it's used to take away our spirit, our spirit and resistance and resilience. So, like, on that broad level, but, you know, it's, prisons also specifically have been used as a tool of reproductive oppression and controlling populations and, you know, so...
Other questions?
Should I pass these out? I don't know how. Yeah.
If nobody else has, does it done in other states as well?
Shackling.
It's pretty.
I think there are.
Go back to slavery.
There are only shackling prisoners or shackling pregnant women.
There
are only 10 states plus the Federal Bureau of Prisons. It might be 11 now that specifically prohibit shackling of women in prison, and it's not
during labor.
Okay. And it's not because it's explicitly prohibit, which means that there's like 40 states that, you know, have no explicit prohibition on this. And in New York State, which passed anti-shackling legislation last summer, I think it was, it was because incarcerated women and formerly incarcerated women made this a point, and they actually rallied. So women on the inside were protesting in the ways that they could. Women on the outside who were either formerly incarcerated or were their allies also protested. And one of the things that they did was then Governor Patterson of New York was leaving office. Like, he wasn't running for another term. So they pinpointed it on him, and they were like, you will sign this bill. And they actually got women to dress up in like prison uniforms with fake bellies, and they shackled them, and they stood outside the governor's Midtown office. So there's a lot of people coming in and out. It's like Midtown Manhattan. And you suddenly see this line of like supposedly pregnant women shackled, and you're just like, what the hell is that? And somebody would hand you a flyer and talk to you about this and be like, did you know that New York State allows, you know, its prisons to shackle women in labor? And people would be like, oh, no, I didn't. And, you know, like, and then there was a public outcry about this. But most people, I think, don't know, you know, like, about this. Like, when I've done presentations to, like, mothers groups, when I say, did you know that New York State allows women in labor to be shackled?
Mandates, right?
California.
Isn't that what you said, that it's mandated?
It's not mandated. Well, it's... California, you know, remember there are 37 counties in California, so each county jail has its own process, its own procedure. So in some counties it's mandated, in some it's not. So it's hard to say exactly what the process is.
So this has happened because there's been like a swelling of outcry, but it's not because, you know, a governor up there, you know, suddenly is like, oh, wait. Today, yeah. I realized
this
is
wrong.
I got
that one figured out.
Other questions? I actually have a question for Vanessa, if you don't mind. Sure. Can you talk a little bit about the TGI project?
Yeah, TGI. Well, I haven't been on the ground as much in the last couple of years, but they work with transgender women who've been locked up or and who are locked up in California's jails and prisons. So they do, you know, they started a mentorship project recently for girls who come out or who are out in the community. They are now, like, doing more policy work, right, getting their members more involved in legislative campaigns. I mean, they've been involved for a while, but I think they, as they grow, you know, as active, they've been able to do that more. Was there something else that...
How people can
connect,
support or
you
be involved or connect?
You can find them online at www.tgijp.org. They have a Facebook page. You can become a monthly donor and support that work.
Can you tell me What's the group?
Oh, the Transgender, Gender, Marrying, and Intersex Justice Project.
Oh, okay. And it's under, and you look it up under
TGIJP.org.
Yeah. You can be Facebook friends.
Yes, or you can like them.
You can like them.
I can.
You can like them on Facebook. Yeah.
Other questions?
So what are you working on right now in New York? What's your...
Me?
Yeah. I mean, is there... I know a lot of things, but is there a particular sort of legislative issue that is most preeminent now, or are you...
Me, personally, I've been working with a group called WORTH, Women on the Rise Telling Her Story, which is a group of formerly incarcerated women who are doing a lot of advocacy work, but they're also doing like a more radical reentry work with women who are coming out of this prison in actually in Chelsea, Manhattan, which is like where like all the fancy art galleries and stuff now are. But they're doing a reentry program from like a more radical perspective, and like using popular education, talking to them about like what do you think about like when you think about health, you know, like what does a healthy body look like, what do healthy relationships look like, and sort of like challenging some of these ideas that people have about like why they're in prison. Not like you did something bad and wrong and deserve to be stuck in this cage, but also what are all these other forces coming at you, and then like what choices, you know, can you be making when you're like looking at the fact that there's like racism and classism and police brutality and, you know, drug addiction and trauma and everything else going on in your lives. So I mean, that's what I've been working on, sort of like in a personal slash prison level. God, there's like a couple of things coming up on the legislative thing, and I can't remember them off the top of my head. There also, I mentioned earlier that there's the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act, which mandates that if a child is in foster care for 15 of the past 22 months, the state has to start terminating parental rights. And in New York State, again, along with the like anti-shackling, one of the other things that formerly incarcerated women and incarcerated mothers who wrote testimonials and, you know, like the children that they could find, managed to galvanize enough support that there's now in New York the ASFA expanded discretion bill, which gives social workers the right, the ability to say, we're not going to start, you know, cutting off those parental rights, because obviously this parent is trying to stay in contact as best as he or she can, you know, despite the fact that they're incarcerated, they're like 100 miles away, you know, like their child is 4 and can't read yet, you know, like, et cetera, et cetera. And you sort of like look at all the obstacles there are. So, and that was like another big thing that just happened in New York.
California has a similar law, although it's not as good as the New York one, where the whole thing in California was slightly different. It was actually worse than the 15 of the last 22 months. It was that if a child were under the age of 18 months, they had 6 months to reunify. And the parent mother had 6 months to reunify with her baby. It was really an attempt. It was a blatant baby stealing attempt.
Totally.
You know, those are the people who are most likely to be adopted.
Right. I have a question about that too, just in terms of, it does seem that there is, you know, when you have this time limit and then you have this sort of fostering and you have the parents who are like willing to foster, so it seems to me it's advocating towards these foster people who are just, you know, desperate for children or whatever.
Right. Fast track adoptions. That's what.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a fast track adoption.
And I'm sure this is national. In California, there's adoption money. Every child who gets adopted.
Yes.
But that child actually, if they were in a foster care situation and they get adopted, the child has lifetime health care.
18, I think.
Whatever. That, you know, during, for the parent, there's a major.
It's like $500 to $700 a month, I think.
Plus, the state gets money. The state actually gets adoption money. Now, there's no money if a, you know, for a grandparent to take care of the grandchild. And in fact, it can be a very desperate situation. Except it's about to get a lot worse, as every social service in California is about to get a lot worse. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Anything?
Oh,
you
have a question?
No,
thanks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good question. Do you want us to mail these in?
If you want, I can take them and I'll fax them. They all go, the fax number's not on here. So you could mail them in if you want to, or I can take them back to my office and fax them tomorrow. Or we'll bundle them up and mail them to the governor.
Excellent.
Any other questions? Thank you all so much for coming. We're here if you want to like talk to us individually. There are books here. The Revolution Starts at Home, which Vanessa is a contributor to. You know, it's here. It talks about, you know, like combating intimate violence in activist communities. And so, like, if we're talking about, which we didn't really talk about tonight, but if we're talking about relying less on the prisons and policing to keep us safe, like, what do we do for safety? We don't just say, if you can't defend yourself, you know, too bad, so sad. But, like, what are some practices? Some people think that, you know, but, what have people been doing? What are some, like, what are some models we can look at and then take back to our own communities? There's Sin's amazing book, Low Bite, and then there's my book, Resistance Behind Bars.
And one last thing. There's a new movie. It's not around now. It's going to come back to San Francisco called Crime After Crime, which is the story of one woman, Debbie Piegler, she didn't actually even kill her batterer. Her batterer was killed, and she did many, many years, and it's a really kind of amazing story of her ability to stay focused on getting out and her attorney's abilities to really work at pace under the worst of circumstances. At one point, the district attorney in Los Angeles said, "You're right, she should be out," signed a paper. Debbie started packing up her bags to go, and then the DA, they reneged. Steve Cooley, who's the district attorney in L.A., took it back. And, I mean, it was an amazing story. And so this movie was at Sundance. It did really well. It just was here and as part of the San Francisco Film Festival, won Best Documentary. I'm happy to say that. But it's going to be actually distributed through Oprah Winfrey's network and stuff. It will be back in the Bay Area in, I think, June or July.
What's the title again?
Crime After Crime. It's an extraordinary movie.
What did you think of the Eileen Wuornos movie?
It was about 7 years ago?
Was it that long? I don't know.
Yeah, but I'm back, I think. I remember wearing stickers of all the men who made their show. She only turned 17. But I never saw the movie.
This is in mind, so this is how I remember, but I frankly don't remember it well.
Okay.
All right. On that note, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.